You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Kinetter, in for Rob Ferret. We all run into conflicts in our lives, and sometimes that can be a good thing. It pushes us to consider other viewpoints or be better people. But some disagreements run deeper. When two people or two groups start seeing each other as the enemy, talking across the divide can feel impossible. Our next guest has spent years studying high conflict and says if we understand how it works, we'll have a better chance to turn down the temperature and have some meaningful discussions. Amanda Ripley is a journalist and author. Her latest book is called High Conflict: Why We Get Trapped and How We Get Out. She talked with Central Time host Rob Ferret.
When, Amanda, does a normal conflict, which can actually be good and healthy, turn into this high conflict?
Right. So conflict itself is not the enemy. It's when conflict distills into a kind of us versus them feud and eventually takes on a life of its own. And our brain behaves differently. We start making mistakes. We miss opportunities. And everything we do to try to end the conflict usually makes it worse. That's a sign that you're in high conflict.
You talk to a lot of people who've been in conflict or dealt with it in different ways. You learned some lessons in a couple different ways from Gary Friedman, a lawyer who started working with divorce in a different way. And this is a really personal example of how high conflict can spiral out of control between two people. How did he tackle divorce differently?
You know, Gary was a traditional family law attorney, and he just found himself getting really dispirited with the way most legal proceedings leave everyone feeling a little worse, even the so-called winner. So he ended up, two friends of his who were getting divorced, a couple, they came to him and they said, this was years ago, and they said, could you help us through this divorce? And he said, well, I'd actually have to represent just one of you, and then someone else would have to represent the other. And he just started, you know, kind of parroting all the usual legalese. And they were upset and they said, why can't there be a way we can all work this out in a room together? And so he took a risk. He'd never done it before. At the time, it was pretty unheard of. And that's what he did. And they worked together for 4 months in this room, and it wasn't easy, but it wasn't two lawyers hashing it out while everybody else sat on the sidelines. It was the people who really owned the problem and understood what the solutions should be. And that became something we now call conflict mediation, which is a huge practice that is really outside the normal kind of us versus them arena of the legal system, the traditional legal system.
And there are a lot of lessons in this that apply to the other kinds of conflict you talk about. But starting with that core idea that, okay, going into this, you're adversaries. This is an adversarial relationship. And whether we're talking about divorce or politics or whatever, once you're on team A and I'm on team B, certain things start to happen. What happens then, Amanda?
You know, there's something about humans that once you sort us into two groups, it just brings out our worst conflict instincts. There's been a ton of research on this, but one example that I think is kind of fun to think about is conflict in outer space. So this is something NASA has looked at quite a bit because they want to do these deep space missions to Mars. So they really can't have dysfunctional conflict on a Mars mission, right? You need each other, you're in a confined space, it's stressful. So they've done these simulations of deep space missions, which are totally fascinating. And the longest simulation of a deep space mission to date, which was conducted in Moscow a few years ago, six men from four countries spent 17 months living in a small concrete building pretending to go to Mars without sunrises or sunsets, with no real-time contact with friends or family. And each week they answered a survey about interpersonal conflicts. And there were 49 conflicts that they bothered to report. Presumably there were many more that didn't make the survey. And so one lesson NASA has learned is that you cannot pick a no-conflict crew. Crew members get distressed by bad news from home and take it out on one another. They have trouble sleeping, get on each other's nerves. You know, just like on Earth, there's unlimited sources of conflict in outer space. But here's the thing. There's one particular kind of conflict that's virtually guaranteed to happen, which is conflict between the crew and ground control down on Earth, right? So that's the power of the binary. Anytime you break humans into two groups, Democrats and Republicans, white, black, good, evil, crew, ground control, it tends to bring out instincts that make conflict less healthy. Not always, but usually. There's this one group here in space, my group, and that other one down on Earth, the other. So a lot of the astronauts' frustration gets redirected onto ground control. And in that particular Mars simulation, the crew reported 5 times as many conflicts with ground control as with each other.
We're talking to Amanda Ripley about her new book, High Conflict, Why We Get Trapped and How We Get Out. Amanda, as you describe high conflict, it sounds overwhelming and scary, but a big point of your work is that even in the worst situations, it is possible to come out of it. And I want to look at maybe the most extreme situation in you present in the book, Sandra in Colombia, who's involved in this generations-long brutal guerrilla war in her country as a combatant. Can you share a little of her story and how she came out of this, what looked to me like an unsolvable conflict situation?
Right. Yeah. So I went to Colombia because I wanted to see what this country, I mean, this is a country for better and for worse that knows a ton about conflict, right? And they have spent many decades trying to get people to leave political, violent conflict. And many things they've tried have not worked, but some things have. And so for this project, I ended up spending time with Sandra, whom you mentioned, who, like a lot of people who entered Colombia's civil war, started out doing it as a young girl. So she was about 12 years old. She witnessed a neighbor of hers who was an elder who was respected get assassinated right in front of her eyes by gunmen who just pulled up and shot her. And it was very upsetting. And she'd been, you know, with her family on the run for many years because of the violence in Colombia. So she decided then and there to leave her family and join the FARC, which is the large guerrilla group in Colombia. And she spent years engaged in this high conflict. And then eventually, as have many thousands of other FARC members, left the conflict willingly, entering a demobilization and reintegration program run by the Colombian government. So it was not an easy process by any means, but what was really interesting for me was to see the patterns in her experience and how they connected with the other people I followed. You know, I followed a politician in California, a former gang leader in Chicago, an environmental activist in England. And in every case, including Sandra in Colombia, all these people were at some point trapped in high conflict, and they're not anymore. But they didn't stop fighting. They didn't suddenly change their mind. Sandra still fights for justice for the Colombian people, but they're much more effective in how they do it. So that was the interesting distinction for me that, you know, I came into this trying to figure out, looking for hope, you know, to understand how do people get out of really ugly conflicts, personal, political, all kinds of conflict. And what I found out was it's not about getting out of conflict. It's really about getting out of high conflict. And how does that happen? And how can you nudge people out of high conflict at scale?
And what is a first step toward that nudge?
One thing that's very important is to recognize saturation points. This is a point at which the conflict begins to feel too heavy to bear. And it's sort of like hitting bottom for an alcoholic, right? It's any kind of shock that happens to the conflict system. In gang violence, it could be as simple as a snowstorm. So there's a period of peace for 24 hours. Or it could be somebody dies or somebody gets shot, or in an ugly divorce, it could be a child gets sick. It's something that destabilizes the conflict temporarily. Now, this is where other people are really important. The people around you who are not in thrall to high conflict help you realize all that you've lost. So waiting for those moments, seizing those saturation points, it's very, very important. Like, timing matters a lot. And then once you do that, one of the things that's common to all those stories that I mentioned is that nobody I know who has left high conflict did it without distancing themselves from the conflict entrepreneurs in their lives.
Conflict entrepreneurs, tell us who they are.
Those are the people, or sometimes companies, or sometimes media outlets or platforms that exploit conflict for profit in some cases, or attention or power. Often it's for meaning, a sense of purpose. But these are the people, sometimes they're in our, you know, regular life, the people who seem to sort of delight in every twist and turn the conflict takes, right? And I'm sure I've been a conflict entrepreneur at some point. As a journalist, it's very easy to do that. So realizing what's happening, who is benefiting from the conflict, because it's usually only the conflict entrepreneurs, and distancing yourself from those people or platforms or channels if you want to get out of high conflict. In the case of Curtis Toler, a former high-ranking gang leader I followed in Chicago, he literally moved across town. So he physically distanced himself. And then two things happened. First, people couldn't find him easily at first. And secondly, when his cousin was brutally murdered, he didn't know who did it, right? So it slowed down the conflict, which is key to getting out of high conflict. So he wasn't able or interested in taking revenge and continuing that cycle because he had a little bit of distance.
That's journalist Amanda Ripley talking with Rob Ferret. Amanda is the author of the book, High Conflict, Why We Get Trapped and How We Get Out. Coming up, we'll hear the rest of their conversation, including a discussion about how a progressive Jewish congregation in New York City leaned into conflict to learn more about groups of people that they differed from. Stay with us here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Dean Kinetter. Right now, we're listening back to a talk with journalist Amanda Ripley, author of the book, High Conflict, Why We Get Trapped and How We Get Out. She spoke with Central Time host Rob Ferret. Here's the rest of their conversation.
Amanda, I want to spend some time on the last chapter of your book, a really powerful story, a liberal synagogue congregation in New York, a conservative group of correctional officers in Michigan, and they end up doing mutual field trips and staying with each other. Can you tell us about that story? We could take some time on this one because it's pretty powerful.
Yeah, it's a really wild story, and it starts on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, where there's a mega synagogue called B'nai Jeshurun. And it, over the century, has become one of the most influential Jewish communities in the United States. And a few years ago, this synagogue nearly came undone, torn apart by internal political controversy over Israel. And this is something that has happened in other synagogues. In this case, because of its influence and location, this controversy landed on the front page of the New York Times. It was very embarrassing for everyone involved. People started withholding their donations. Others threatened to leave the synagogue altogether. The rabbis were more left-leaning on Israel, and many of the congregants were more right-leaning, very protective of Israel. And this was a shock to the rabbis. The reaction was so sudden and volcanic. So they did what most of us do when we encounter sudden conflict within our own group, which is they really tried to make it go away and hope it never came back, right? Which generally, you know, unfortunately doesn't work, right? But they tried to apologize and move on. And then, of course, it flared up again a few months later over something else. Usually that kind of conflict, if you don't deal with it in a healthy way, just kind of ferments underground. So they ended up finally, after years of this kind of agony, deciding that they were going to do conflict differently. They were just going to literally spend a year going into conflict in a careful way instead of trying to avoid it. And they brought in some mediators who had worked on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And they had like hard conversations, and they tried to understand each other, even as they totally disagreed. And it was really a massive investment in cultural change within this one institution, which most institutions don't want to do. Like they'll have a workshop, but they won't invest, you know, that amount of time in it. Anyway, they ended up getting to a place where they could, as the rabbi put it for me, tolerate the discomfort of someone else's opinion. So even as they disagreed, they felt like they understood each other better, which is like the key to the kingdom. Then when they came into another conflict, as inevitably happens in this case over whether the rabbis should perform interfaith marriages, they were able to do the same thing, to lean into the conflict, to have hard conversations, to really get into it and try to understand what's underneath it. Like, what is this conflict really about? Most conflicts are not about the things we talk about. They're about identity, fear, that kind of thing. And then this gets to your question finally. They after Donald Trump was elected president in 2016, most of the people in the synagogue didn't know anyone who had voted for Trump. They were very distressed. So they didn't know how to lean into conflict because they didn't know anyone with whom they were in conflict with over this. So eventually they end up doing this exchange program with a group of Christian conservatives who live in rural Michigan and work at their local prisons as corrections officers, where literally the New Yorkers, the liberal New York Jews come to Michigan and stay in the homes of the conservatives for 3 days. They have all kinds, they lean into the conflict again. They do things together. They go to a firing range. They eat Superman ice cream, which the New Yorkers have never had. And they have really difficult conversations. And this magical thing happens where they become curious about each other, which they weren't before they met each other. And then the Michigan conservatives came to New York City for 3 days, stayed in the apartments of the New Yorkers, went to the synagogue for services, visited Trump Tower, all kinds of things. And it wasn't like this kumbaya was there with them. It was very interesting to watch. It wasn't like a kumbaya, you know, moment of fantasy. It was much more interesting than that. You know, it was really interesting to see the things that surprised each other. It was sort of amazing how little they understood each other beforehand and how much affection they came to have for each other, even as they continued to like wildly disagree on many things.
And that's a key. They didn't try to persuade each other. It doesn't sound like anybody really changed their politics at all, but they changed their understanding of each other's motivations.
Yeah, it's hard to explain because I think we've sort of lost that awareness that there is a third way. Like you can keep screaming at each other, right? Trying to persuade each other, which doesn't work. You can surrender or give in, right? Or which doesn't feel right, isn't right often. But there's another way, which is trying to understand each other even as you disagree. And what you find out is you get much more clear and accurate about where the disagreements actually are. And you're able to hold a lot more complexity in your head. So one of the women, Martha Acklesberg, who went from New York to Michigan, she told me, you know, that there was something about this trip that made her feel like the person she most wanted to be. You know, she was open. She was curious. She was also honest about expressing her own beliefs. She ended up hosting a Michigan conservative named Caleb Follett, who literally could not be more different from her in many ways. You know, he has an arsenal of guns in his home. And he listens to, you know, he watches Fox News. And Martha is a liberal academic who started the Women's Studies Department at Smith College. Their differences in age and class and politics and religion. But they came to really have this incredible, obvious affection for each other. And she said to me, you know, I wish I could appear everywhere in my life the way I felt called to appear on this trip. Present, open, able to be surprised. And I think that's the mark of good conflict, right? When you can disagree and still feel like the kind of person you want to be.
Let's bring on a caller. Bill is with us in Milwaukee. Bill, hi.
Hi. Wow, your guest almost said everything I was going to say. And that is that understanding means now I can do something I wasn't able to do before. Understanding begins with listening. I read a book called Getting More. He said, let's grow up, please. You can't have everything, but you can have more. I heard of a couple who said that the reason that they lived so long together was that they never hated each other at the same time. There was always somebody there to look out for the homestead.
Bill, thanks for that call. And Bill started with the listening there, Amanda, which is a key. Lessons for listening for us and maybe for us in the media while you're at it.
Yeah, you know, I did about 80 hours of conflict mediation training for this book, and I went into it a little bit overconfident. I thought I knew how to interview people because I'd done it for 20 years as a journalist, but it turned out that, you know, there's a difference between looking like you're listening, you know, nodding and smiling and furrowing your brow and laughing at the right moments. There's a difference between that and proving to someone that you are really trying to understand them, you know, which usually takes the form of listening and then playing back for them in the most elegant language you can muster, the most important thing to them that you heard, and then checking to see if you got it right. It may sound sort of squishy, but there's actually a ton of really interesting research on this that shows that when you do this, when you prove, you demonstrate through actions that you have listened, even if you get it wrong, which you often do, right? And people say, no, 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 that's not exactly right. People open up. The next thing they say tends to be less extreme and more interesting. People almost never feel heard, but it is often the thing they want most.
Amanda, in our last few moments, I mean, had I done the work that you'd done, I'm not sure if I would feel frightened for the future or hopeful for the future, looking at the conflicts you've looked at. Where do you end up falling?
Rob, that is like, it changes day by day. On the one hand, I feel much more hopeful because I have seen it. Like, I was skeptical of this idea that people could have good conflict. And I have now seen it in front of my face enough times that I know it's a real thing. I've seen people make that journey from high conflict to good conflict. So I know it can be done. I also know that we have set up a lot of our institutions, from politics to many journalistic outlets to social media, to incite high conflict. So we incentivize conflict entrepreneurs. Now, the good thing is we can change that. Like, we built those things and we can redesign them. But, you know, it starts with understanding high conflict and getting more sophisticated so we can fight smart, you know, because the truth is, whether we like it or not, as Americans, we are married to each other, right? Like, we can get divorced, but we have kids together. So we have to find a way to fight that leaves us with some sense of dignity.
Amanda, thanks as always for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Amanda Ripley is a journalist and author. She talked with Rob Ferret about her latest book, High Conflict: Why We Get Trapped and How We Get Out. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll dig more into the science of belief, opinion, and persuasion. Also, Russian bombings in Ukraine have killed dozens of people this month. We'll look at how the war is changing and what difference U.S. defense support is making. That and more coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we hear from a professor working to prevent child abuse about a report released in May detailing sexual assault and cover-up in the Southern Baptist Convention and what can change for organizations like that in the future. I'm Dean Kinetter, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Dean Kinetter, in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Tim Michaels is racking up endorsements in the Wisconsin's Republican primary for governor, and the latest Marquette poll shows two candidates in the Democratic primary for U.S. Senate are neck and neck. A political scientist joins us to break down the latest Wisconsin election news. First, leaders from the Southern Baptist Convention released a third-party report this May detailing a history of sexual abuse allegations and cover-ups within the religious organization. The investigation comes after reporting 3 years ago of more than 700 cases of sexual abuse from about 400 people connected to the Southern Baptist Convention. Top leaders from the convention are said to have mishandled the cases that they knew about for as much as 20 years before the reporting came out. Former president of the SBC, Ed Litton, spoke about the report in an interview with ABC News.
Well, the rumors were always out there that these things were happening. There were several attempts made at our convention meetings to bring this to light, but they were very successfully pushed down, and this report was long overdue. Southern Baptist asked for this, demanded this.
We want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. What has surprised you if you've been following this investigation? What do you think organizations, religious or not, should do to change in the future after something like this? Why do you think this type of story is so common for large institutions? Are you a member of the Southern Baptist Convention? If so, what do you think about this story and what should come next? Call 800-642, that's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Marcy Hamilton is the founder and CEO of Child USA, a nonprofit think tank dedicated to preventing child abuse and neglect. She's also a professor of practice in political science at the University of Pennsylvania. Marcy, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, some of these cases we found out about went unaddressed by the Southern Baptist Convention for as many as 20 years, despite leaders knowing about them. What kind of cover-ups did we learn about in this report that kept these cases from coming out?
Well, the Southern Baptists were much like other organized religions, whether it's Catholic or Jehovah's Witnesses, in which they preferred the adults in power. And there's a great phrase in the report that says the problem is casual indifference to child sex abuse. We see this across religions. We see this across universities. It's a nationwide problem, but it was just as rampant in the Southern Baptists as anywhere else.
The Southern Baptist Convention has at least 13 million members nationwide. A few of those, three to be exact, names from that report were tied to Wisconsin. However, here in Wisconsin, the Catholic Church is much more prominent. Obviously, a similar story in the Catholic Church. What kind of parallels were you seeing between the two organizations?
It's interesting because they're organized so differently. One's hierarchical, one's more of a flat system, but the truth is identical behaviors in that children would be sexually abused. They would try to reach out in whatever way they could, and they were either ignored or they were just treated as though they needed to get over it. And it's identical in the way that the Catholic hierarchy and the Baptist pastors have been approaching this. They've been far more interested in telling kids to forgive and forget abuse than to getting them the help they need and to bringing the abusers to justice.
I think in both instances, we've heard about religion itself, religious thinking, lessons, dogma being used as a tool for abusers, especially for young people. Can you talk a little bit more about how that can make this problem worse?
Well, you know, one of the ways that religious organizations operate, and this is in the report, is that they can treat the men as superior and the children and the women as inferior. And so the men's concerns about being incarcerated or being shamed in public because they're abusers take precedence, and then the children are told to just please be quiet and go away. That's what happened in the Baptist Church. And at the same time, theologically, they completely torqued the meaning of confession and forgiveness, just as the Catholic Church has done in Wisconsin, in which they have said that church autonomy, the protection of church from all outside law and social obligations, means they can't be held accountable. And that's a distortion of, first of all, the Bible's text, but also that's a way of talking that keeps the powerful in place. They're not responsible to the larger public good and keeps them much more worried about their image and protecting their income than about the victims.
Have there been similar ways that the Catholic Church and the Southern Baptist Convention have used legal mechanisms to slow down investigations or avoid accountability?
Absolutely. Both denominations and many others argue vehemently that the courts cannot get documents from their records that will show the abuse. Both organizations are lobbying against access to justice for the victims and really are counting on the courts creating no open opportunities for the victims. So, you know, this is something I've said for a very long time about the Catholic bishops, and it's equally true for the SBC, is that so long as you're lobbying against your own victims in state legislatures and arguing they shouldn't get access to justice, you're going to have a problem. They can't solve their problem unless the victims have access to justice.
We're talking right now with Marcy Hamilton, founder and CEO of Child USA, a nonprofit think tank dedicated to preventing child abuse and neglect. We're talking about a recent report that found a pattern of sexual abuse and cover-up within the Southern Baptist Convention. And Marcy, you mentioned providing access to legal representation, a pathway to justice for survivors. What are some of the practical things that can change to provide that for people?
Well, the most important, and we've been working on Wisconsin for years, is a very tough state to crack on this particular issue. What's needed is that the victims from the past whose claims have already expired have the opportunity to have them revived. We've had roughly half of the states revive expired statutes of limitations for child sex abuse victims in some way. And what we've had in Wisconsin is, first we had Archbishop Dolan, now Cardinal Dolan of New York, actively lobbying, in fact, publicly testifying against the victims in the state legislature. And now we have the Southern Baptists who are publicly stating that they will not support, in fact, they will argue against the victims having access to justice. So what that means is that victims don't have the leverage that they need in court to get the records. The big losers when you don't give victims access to justice are the public. We will never learn the full extent, the facts, the way in which our children have been endangered unless there's full accountability and full release of the information. We really just need the truth. And what many of the religious organizations and universities and others are doing right now is they're saying to lawmakers, we'll clean our own dirty laundry, we've got it. The problem is we know what happens when you let a private institution clean their own dirty laundry. They just put it away. And I don't care what the report says about the fact they're going to do better in the future, which they darn well better, or they're going to be in a lot of trouble. They're not going out of their way to make the record straight on exactly how nefarious and disastrous their policies were.
You mentioned reviving cases that might have expired because of the statute of limitations. What does bringing something, a case back after that statute has passed, what does that involve? Does it require a change in law? Is it a case-by-case basis?
We need a change in law. And there have been bills, including this year, introduced that would enact the window that meant that we learned about 1,150 victims in California in 2003, the very first major window. New York had 11,000 victims come forward. We know about drama teachers. We know about coaches that we never would have learned about but for opening these windows. And so if parents want to know or need to know if their children are safe and where they are safe, that's what these laws do. Gives them the information and tells them the questions to ask because they'll learn about all the mistakes that have been made in the past. But right now, it's many of our religious leaders that are standing in the way of parents getting that truth.
We're talking with Marcy Hamilton, founder and CEO of Child USA and a professor of practice in political science at the University of Pennsylvania. She's talking with us about the roughly 700 sexual assault cases and accusations that have come out in recent reporting regarding the Southern Baptist Convention. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you believe convention leaders should have done when they heard about these assaults? What do you think should happen next for organizations like this? If revelations of abuse in the Catholic Church have affected you, what does this new report from the Baptist Convention have you thinking about? What questions do you have about the legal options in cases like this? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. Right now, we're picking up the conversation with Marcy Hamilton, founder and CEO of Child USA, a group focused on preventing child abuse. She's talking with us about a report detailing widespread sexual assault within the Southern Baptist Convention and what might come next. We're also taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What does this story have you thinking about? What questions do you have about the legal options in cases like this? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Marcy, I want to talk a little bit more about what leaders in the SBC knew about abuse that was happening in their organization. As you mentioned, it's a little less hierarchical of a group than the Catholic Church is, but it seems like there was still a lot of knowledge, even when leaders were speaking out about abuse in the Catholic Church. Can you talk about that?
Well, first of all, we don't fully know exactly what they knew because we haven't had the kind of litigation that would tell us the full story. But for as a matter of fact, Baptists started coming forward saying they had been abused not long after the 2002 Spotlight report in the Boston Globe. And so this story has been out there. They've been aware of it, but they've been consistently arguing that because of their organizational structure, they'll never have the same top-down problems. The issue, though, is that pastors move from church to church, and the ones that are abusing children, when they leave the one church, perhaps because of some problems and knowledge, the next church, they abuse another child. And so what they knew is they had problems. They knew they had youth ministers with problems, and they did not take them to the authorities, and they did not remove them from the faith. Instead, the victims watched them be forgiven and protected while the victims were essentially told, thanks for telling us, but that's pretty much it.
Last month, the SBC held a meeting of members where they passed a few new policy issues. They elected a new president, Bart Barber, created a database of, or approved creating a database of abuse claims and abusers, and signed off on creating a group to study changes within the church. What do you think about what came out of that meeting?
Well, I thought it was a good step forward. The prevention policies they laid out, there are some good ones. You've got to have two adults. Whenever anyone's with children, that's a good rule in sports and everywhere else. You have to have open doors when children are present, another great rule. No one-on-one transportation. You can't let the adult take the kid alone in a car. Screening, those are good. But a lot of this didn't include the larger systemically needed changes. So there's no talk about having a code of conduct that every employee and volunteer must review and sign regularly. There's no protection for whistleblowers, and that's something that's critically important. People should be able to come forward about their concerns about a child being sexually abused without being shut out or isolated because they've come forward. There's some specific proposals that I don't see there. For example, teenage volunteers should not be supervising young children without adult supervision. So there's a fair amount that they're stepping forward, but they have quite a far way to go to have a really high level child protective system. And what I would say to the parents in the SBC right now is it's an environment that is not yet going to curb the acts of sexual abuse by those intending to have sex with children. They're just not there. They're not going to be there overnight. And so parents, I'm sorry, I'm having to say this repeatedly all over the country, you have to be hypervigilant now because the instinct to protect the institution, that's really hard to change in the rank and file. You may have some on the top saying that, but I've seen various quotes and statements out in the press at the lower levels, and it's going to take a long time to educate the entire entire set of believers that you have to take this seriously. You have to go to the authorities if you have a report, and you have to put the healing of the child first and foremost. Hard to do when the institution's been doing the opposite so long.
We're talking with Marcy Hamilton, founder of Child USA, talking about abuse within the Southern Baptist Convention. We're also taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Let's go to the calls now. We have Dave in Stevens Point. Hi, Dave.
Hi.
What'd you want to bring up?
Well, I think she just hit it, and that was the main thing. And it's not just churches. It's the Boy Scouts. It's any other large organization, maybe not even large organizations, but it's the instinct of leaders of all of these institutions to protect the institution instead of the people that they're supposed to be serving. And until we can get past that with the leadership in churches and the other institutions, we're going to continue to have this problem. So that's pretty much what I have to say.
Dave, thanks for the call. Marcy, what do you think?
Absolutely. And what's heartening is when the general public steps up and sees that and knows it and says it. So that's a great comment and really important.
And we do see, as Dave mentioned, not just religious organizations, athletic organizations, the Boy Scouts, any sort of big group can be subject to this this kind of problem. And I'm wondering if you, Marcy, have seen organizations that have reformed for the better, where things are really working.
Well, there's a lot left to do in the United States. And so we actually studied all of the 32 United States archdioceses because they were the most sued. So you would expect they would have made the most changes. And what we found out as a matter of scientific fact is that the policies are all over the place and none of them are complete. So children are at risk in the Catholic Church, despite knowing about this cover-up since 2002. That's 20 years. So no, there is no perfect institution yet. We're really wrestling with changing the system, which means changing people's minds, that you really do put everything down when a child indicates they've been sexually abused, and you immediately go to the authorities and you immediately hold people to account. And, you know, for the rank and file, for the believer in the pews, it's intimidating to tell your pastor. And if a pastor says, that guy's one of our most valued members of our whole congregation, you get the message. This is about the organization and you better shut up. And the child then doesn't get that sense of, wow, the institution's here for me, and also doesn't get the sense of justice. It's amazing what happens if you take a child who has been sexually abused to the authorities and show them that what was done to them was a crime, was wrong, and it wasn't their fault. That can be healing, and so far the SBC has a terrible record on that. We'll see how far down they go in both implementing that and enforcing it. In fact, my biggest question here, it's not just that they set out some new policies, but how are they going to enforce them?
We just have about a minute left, Marcy, but I wanted to ask, in addition to abusers themselves, is it possible to have consequences for those at the top who might have known and ignored a problem?
Absolutely. There's criminal behavior by those at the top of every organization in the country, frankly, that has had these massive cover-ups. So whether we're talking about the Olympic system or we're talking about universities or schools or the churches, there's liability and there should have been criminal charges against those in power. But the problem is prosecutors are political beings and it's pretty intimidating and difficult to charge the bishop that everybody loves, the pastor that everybody adores, and expect to get reelected. So that's why our view at Child USA is we must educate everyone. The public needs to understand this so they'll just absolutely demand that kind of accountability.
We'll leave it there. Marcy, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Marcy Hamilton, founder and CEO of Child USA, a nonprofit think tank devoted to preventing child abuse and neglect. We've been talking about a recent reporting that revealed a pattern of sexual abuse and cover-up within the Southern Baptist Convention and how the group is responding. If you or someone you know has been sexually assaulted, the National Hotline for Sexual Assault is 800-656-HOPE. That's 800-656-HOPE. The Wisconsin Department of Justice is also actively investigating clergy abuse. Their number, 877-222-2620. We also have their online reporting form linked at wpr.org/centraltime. Stay with us. More to come here on Central Time.